Well, as many of you know, by day, I'm a philosopher of physics, normal philosopher of physics, hardworking, simple-minded, whatnot. And but lately, by night, over the last few years, I've secretly been learning some psychology, cog sci, psychophysics. Why? Well, because I see learning this stuff is essential to my my grand plan, which is, as many of you know from my Friday talk, my grand plan is, you know, the complete and total annihilation of the 10th theory of time and all of its cognates and friends. And I've been looking at all this stuff in philosophy of mind and cog sci and that regarding time perception. I think, you know, because I am a philosopher of physics, you know, the result at the end of the talk will be, Craig, keep your day job. But on the other hand, so I'm not exactly sure, you know, I think a lot of what I'm going to say maps into, say, the color debate, and I'm not, sophisticated with the color debate. I'm happy to, if it maps in, I'm happy to take whatever the best position is there, and then, you know, but not argue it myself. Same thing, you know, people have asked me when I've given this talk before whether I'm, you know, explaining or explaining away intuitions, and a big question mark appears over my head, and I don't know. But anyway, it's clear I'm doing something. Okay. So, just to set up a little bit of the background, the sort of the master plan of the destruction of the tensed view, I like to set up the problem of time slightly differently than it's often set up in the metaphysics of time literature. So, as you know, objects are booming and buzzing by. There's all sorts of, you know, properties changing. You know, vivid perceptions are fading into the past, into your memories. You know, we feel ourselves inexorably slipping into the future. So you have that picture on the right of our busy day and all the stuff we're doing, our phenomenology, the manifest image, as it were. By contrast, the time of fundamental physics, it doesn't slow down or speed up. It doesn't privilege any particular point as the now. It doesn't even, fundamental physics seems not even to pick out an arrow to time one way or the other. In fact, if the theory I offered in Friday's talk is right, then time is, in physics, is really just a kind of honorific we give to one of the dimensions of space for being so nice to us. So anyway, to echo another debate, then we have this kind of huge discrepancy between the time we experience and the time we have in physics. So the time in physics is lots of structure, you know, topological structure, metrical structure. But if you look around, there's really basically three things. I sort of identify three things you don't see in it that are often attributed to it, to time. So you don't have, if you look at any theory of physics, it doesn't identify any particular value of t for any coordinization as now. Fundamental physics seems not to have any symmetry, or if it does have any symmetry, it's not one that's connected up in any way, probably with the asymmetries we care about in the manifest image. And then no flow. And so the grand kind of project I'm imagining, I'm sort of writing a book in the sense that I opened a Word file and titled it Brook, but it's to go through and try to solve this problem, the problem of time here, try to reconcile the two. And what I'm going to talk about today is the present part. You can think of what Janan was doing as talking about the flow, you know, trying to fit the flow into the natural science conception of the world without actually having to resort to some sort of special metaphysical solution like in the tensed theory. And you can think of things like that Matthias was talking about the other day as contributing toward the asymmetry, explain the asymmetry in terms of various physical asymmetries like the radiation asymmetry and thermodynamic asymmetry connecting up with, or as he argues, not connecting up with some of the other asymmetries. But clearly that's the sort of way I would want to go. And so then we can ask about the present as well. So people often talk about the present as being very special. And so they just ask a simple question, is the time of natural science incomplete or inaccurate? Is it just, you know, wrong because it's missing out on those facts, features of experience? Has physics just missed those things? Has it missed those things? Or is the time of physics all the time that is needed? Can the rest be explained with, you know, psychology and environmental features and all sorts of things? And so that's the kind of assumption of the project here. So different answers. I don't really like the sort of tense versus tenseless debate. It's all very linguistic-y. But I like to think of it more in terms of you know, just the temporal relations found in physics versus whether you want to add something metaphysical to supplement those. Okay, so on the right-hand side, we call it, but I'll stick with the usual language. On the right-hand side, we've got views that are adding some kind of metaphysical thing to the physical, the temporal relations found in physics. So presentism, becoming, primitive tenses, branches, and whatnot. All of those things distinguish some moment as metaphysically distinguished, right? So on a branching view, there's the moment of the bifurcation of the branches. On a becoming view, the now, the present is, you know, the sort of the moment of creative flux. On presentism, that's all there is. And there's the sorts of views associated with prior and broad. On the left-hand side, we have what's often called the tenseless theory. Past, present, future equally exist. Fundamental properties are just things like earlier than. It can all be defined in terms of earlier than and simultaneous with. There's no distinguished present. This is the kind of view associated with Russell, Smart, Grunbaum. So, you know, just to have a pictorial image, so, you know, kind of becoming view, if this blue is the real stuff, it's sort of the growing block. It's what's real. There, the top edge is the special metaphysically distinguished present. If you're a presentist, there it is. There's the whole world, the one slice, and that's it. Okay. So here's how I see the dialectical situation. The tenseless people have spent about 100 years giving what I call nuclear arguments against tenses. They're nuclear in the sense that, well, the two first. You know, so let's mention the MacTaggart's argument. If MacTaggart's argument is right, then, you know, the tensed view of time is impossible. It's logically contradictory. So it's, you know, this is why, in the sense, it's nuclear. If same thing with this kind of smart broad, how fast is time going type objection. It's kind of a conceptual puzzle. Again, you know, the tensed theory of time just doesn't exist, strictly speaking. There's just no model of it. Then there's sort of no-go theorems with relativity from Putnam. I have a nice fancy one in 2000. That's the only makes it physically impossible in some sense, but still kind of impossible. The problem with these things is that there's ways of weaseling out of every one of them. Damn it! So if there weren't ways of weaseling out of all of those things, I wouldn't have to go through this kind of talk. But there are ways of weaseling out of all of those things. The arguments for the tense view of time all seem to rely on things like the semantics of now, the famous headache argument. You know, I dread the headache tomorrow, but don't care that much about yesterday's headache. And what you might call the temporal knowledge argument. So I know my lecture is now. I don't know the date. How can I know one without the other? How can the one be identical to the other? How can the one event be identical to the other if I can know one and not know the other? Seems to be just like the sort of famous Mary argument for dualism. John Perry, in an article, says almost all the arguments for the tense theory of time are really this versions of the temporal knowledge argument. And then, other tensors are also often always appealing to experience, right? So they say the manifest image that I was talking about before fits better with the tense theory, the tense metaphysics, than the tenseless metaphysics. And so they're always going back to experience. And so what I want to do in the talk is I want to bracket the knowledge argument. So what I want to really do is focus on experience. And so the idea is I want to look at all the... I want to annihilate the argument from experience, if there is any argument from experience. And so that the only motivation for the tense theory comes from things like the temporal knowledge argument, which I don't think have anything to do with experience, really, or very little. And if you think about it, it's just really... The only amount of experience needed to, you know, get the temporal knowledge argument going is enough to. It's really about whether one knowing one proposition entails knowing another proposition. So you just need a tiny, not much experience is needed for to get that argument going. So I want to bracket that argument and focus just on experience and what tensors say about experience. And I see this as filling a gap because since the nuclear arguments don't really work or don't ultimately work, when the debate goes conventional, that is, by conventional I mean a kind of inference to the best explanation of the phenomena, then the detensors, the tensless view, is left slack-jawed in the face of experience. They're not saying that they don't have that much to say. And so you can say some things. It's great to see at this conference, people saying things that would help, like in Janann's talk. I want to go that way as well. So the plan for today is to fight back on the experiential front. Oddly, given the centrality of all these, if you look at the tensed literature, there's lots of appeals to experience all the time. But no one actually looks at the empirical data on temporal experience, to my knowledge. And that's kind of odd. And so I'm going to focus on the present and experience, bracket the knowledge argument, bracket all those nuclear arguments. I'm going to develop a theory that's suggested from my reading of the kind of psychophysics literature on time perception. And then once you have the kind of, sort of put the mind back in the mind-dependent theory of Grunbaum and Horwich and others, and argue that this is a better rival to a better explanation of the phenomena than resorting to a tensed metaphysics. So I'm essentially just going to use Mill's methods and say that the likelihood of the evidence is higher on my hypothesis than on the tensed hypothesis. Okay. Now, section two. Why do you think there are pigs? Well, you've got all these pig experiences, so you might see a pig. You might have visual impressions of pigs in your visual field. You might eat some bacon. Maybe somebody in your some relative is one of those people who like pig calendars. Pictures of pigs and stuff. And so, all that kind of stuff, leads to the inference that really there are pigs. Tensors. Think of the present the same way. We have all these experiences of the present. So there's the right now, the present, this moment right now. Not that one, this one. This experience, and it's this experience that lends itself to the postulation of this objective thing called the now. Okay, which by now I'm meaning some kind of metaphysically distinguished, mind-independent now. Okay. Now, this is the weak part of the talk, but it's not my fault. So when I try to think about what the phenomenology is of the present that people are talking about, it's very hard. And so, like I say here, like Hume looking for himself, I'm looking inside my experiences for a kind of present stamp. I don't see a present stamp. I see, red. I hear, just hear myself. Don't hear all that much. And so, you don't really see, I'm not really getting this, the idea that there's a stamp of my the present. So as I say here, whether something is past, present, or future doesn't change the way it looks. The light from a lighthouse 1 mile away and from Jupiter look the same, even though one image is of an hour in the past and the other is of 0.000005 seconds past. As Miller says, you can't refute someone who claims to see the future in a crystal ball by pointing to the visible pastness of the image. There is no such thing. Let me just mention quickly. There is a kind of divide in the tensed camp about when you're sensing the present, the nowness, what is it? Is it the experience? You're sensing it in the experience itself or in the objects you're perceiving? And so William Craig goes with the latter, and a lot of the other ones go with the former. Craig writes in reaction to the Miller quote just there. As a result of physics and neurology, we now realize that nothing we sense is instantaneously simultaneous with our experience of it as present. But in most cases, the things and events we observe are contained within a brief temporal interval which is present. And our basic belief makes no reference to instants, so that such a basic belief remains properly basic for even scientifically educated folks like ourselves. The fact that under extraordinary circumstances our basic belief in the presentness of some event thing should not turn out to be false is no proof at all, either that we have no basic beliefs concerning the presentness of events, things in the external world, or that such beliefs are not properly basic. Miller is therefore simply wrong when he asserts that we do not observe defeasibly the tense of events. All right, so let me just note that. Let's try to look around for this experience. I mean, the thing that I find so frustrating is when I look in the works of the tensors, it seems like it's a lot of, suppose you're looking to describe pig experiences, you would, you know, maybe mention that they have four legs and things like this. But in the case of the present, it seems like it's a lot of reading the theory into the data. So what is the experience? It's that experience of that external out there now. And that's the sort of sole criterion by which you're grabbing it. So Craig says we're appeared to presently. Schlesinger, the present is palpably real. Smith, the presentness we'd hear, sense and hears in every state of affairs. We have an unreflexive awareness of events as present. Ballas of a detensor says some events are known to be present simpliciter. Well, let me try. Sometimes you see the idea that confinement. Maybe what the idea is our experiences are confined to the present. But I think I agree with Miller. This idea is kind of hopeless to cash this out. It's just you can hit it with a dilemma. If this means that we only experience present events or objects, then this claim is false. The lighthouse Jupiter type case. If instead you rephrase it as the sensory to the sensory experiences we have are present when we have them, then it's contentious. It's going to turn out to either be trivially true or contentious. On the tenseless block, I've got experience. I'm still screaming when I come out of my when I'm born. There's that experience. So if I just rephrase it to just on the slice, then it just says I'm having the experience when I'm having my experience. Oaklander says there's nothing more ontologically speaking to the presence of experience than our being conscious of our experiences when they are happening. Maybe instead of looking at confinement, we can look at the criticisms of the token reflexive theory. So detensors will say E is present means E is roughly simultaneous with a judgment. And people, I think more or less rightly say, well, look, this is just explains a kind of correlation between a propositional attitude about your judgment about an experience. It doesn't really elucidate the experience itself. It just talks about this correlation between the two. And so tensors steadfastly maintain that there is this experience of presentness. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm keep trying, and I'm going to give up in a second and just move on. But maybe there's some kind of presentness qualia or something. And you could maybe explain why it would be so hard to actually get a grasp on it. When you think about it, when you look at the apple there, you could talk about the, it's... you could talk about it, its phenomenological qualities. You could say the color is saturated to a certain degree. It's talk about its brightness and things like this. And you have all these other things you can contrast it with. But in the case of the present, you don't. You might just think, well, maybe I'll compare it to previous states, but then I'm comparing memory states to non-memory states, which doesn't seem fair. So, but maybe since all aspects of my experience of presentness are present, then maybe that's the best you can do. So what I want to do is just assume there is some kind of experience of presentness, go along with them, even though we haven't really been able to cleanly identify it. Now the tensors believe that this experience that we haven't been able to really identify all that well warrants belief in a global objective present. For Craig, for instance, it quote enjoys such powerful positive epistemic status for us that not only can we be said to know that tense and temporal becoming are real, but also that this belief constitutes an intrinsic defeater, which overwhelms the objections brought against it. Try arguing with him about this. He is. So I bracket the knowledge argument and his argument. But of course, it's not automatic. The way the tensors talk sometimes it's like it's automatic that just because you have the experience, there's the thing out there. But I mean, there's from the color literature and from hallucinations and stuff like this. Just because you have the experience of it doesn't mean that there's something. Just because you have experiences of red doesn't mean there's something red out there in the world. Because it could be that there's something red out there in the world, but it's a lively debate. Okay. So it's an open question whether the best inference, that's all I want to point out here, is that it's an open question. Finally, let's get to the cool stuff. Okay, so what? I wonder what time it is. Oh, can I borrow, do you have a watch I can borrow? Okay, so what I want to do, thank you, is sketch a kind of positive framework and go through some experiments, which I think can help confirm the framework, the theory. And so what I want to do is I want to sort of marry a kind of hypothesis suggested from psychology and plug it into this kind of framework that Jeremy Butterfield has for explaining the seeming objectivity of the present, even though there's no objective present. Okay, so Jeremy has this paper called Seeing the Present in the mid-80s, which I've always loved. Let's start from the bottom. You know, what Jeremy starts off noticing is, if you think about macroscopic objects and the changing their property and the way they change their properties, then our world just happens to be, for various law-like and various contingent initial conditioning type reasons, it happens to be that a lot of the macro properties are very stable over short periods of time. So thanks to the electromagnetic forces, the positives and negatives balancing out on a certain scale, thanks to thermodynamics and that, a lot of macroscopic properties are change much more slowly than the rate at which light and sound travels to us. So if you look at some chair, you're sort of forming some belief about some chair. I should have made a red chair. You're forming some belief about a chair. Now there's going to be this visual lag time of about a half a second. But in that time, that lag, you form this belief about the chair at T. But by the time it actually gets through, and you have the thought an object is chair shaped or red or blue, this lag T minus T star. It doesn't typically affect the truth value of the claim, right? And so that's going to be important. So the lag typically does not make the belief about local macroscopic objects false. I mean, of course, it sometimes will, but typically not. Same goes for communication, say by signing. Same goes for other sensory modalities. So sound is very fast as well. Not the signal speed, but the processing speed. So none of those types of information require a timestamp for reliable information transfer. What do I mean by timestamp? You don't need to say. You can just use the chair's that object's chair shape now. I can ignore that T minus T star lag. I don't need to say. Put a clock time, a B time, if you like, attached to it. I don't need this timestamp. I just can say now. I don't even need to say now. I just say that the object's chair-shaped. And it'll typically be true when I say it. However, other things need timestamps. So I don't know how the mail is here, but in the U.S., the mail, the post is dreadful. And if you get bank statements without the dates on them, they would be, useless. They wouldn't be very good information. It takes a long time. Or imagine, you're coming into a house and somebody's burnt the toast. The smell doesn't reliably indicate the timing of the event, right? So the smell of burnt toast lingers in the house for a long time. It's not very reliable. So for those sorts of things, you would need a timestamp. Somebody said, your wife writing a note saying, sorry, I burnt the toast at 8 o'clock. Now, of course, all of this makes good sense from an evolutionary perspective. One always has to watch out with this kind of adaptationist type reasoning, but I don't think it's too controversial to say that the existence of tigers, large lags, tigers plus large lags don't equal good mating. So if you're processing, yesterday and a tiger comes up, this is not going to be conducive in the bedroom. These circumstances and the fact that you see the distant spatial events, contribute, Jeremy says, to, you've got great intersubjective agreement about what happens now, and this sort of agreement plus this sort of the fact that you can see the distant events and the distant spatial events, but you don't, in some sense, see the distant temporal events, can be used to explain why we're tempted to restrict existence to the present and say that we share a now but not a here. So I just refer you over to Jeremy's paper for the development of all of that thought. So let me just now elaborate a little bit on my own. You know, so consider the region over which a timestamp is not needed. You know, so a timestamp again is going to be connected to where you get the region over which you're going to get reliable information for communication and whatnot. Call that a now patch. Then you can just glue these now patches together to form a kind of global present, and that's the idea where you have this is why you're going to think that there's a global present when really there's not. Okay, so this is supposed to explain the alleged objectivity, the apparent objectivity of the present. Okay, but now I think Jeremy's more or less right, but I think you know the main character in the story, the mind, has been left out of the mind-dependent theory of the present. And yet, moreover, it seems important. I mean, just to kind of prelude, I mean, think about, you know, right now, you're looking at me, you're getting the visual impressions from my face, my lips, you're getting the sounds. I don't sound like a poorly dubbed, Godzilla movie. You know, there's the speed of light is going in, 300,000 meters per second. The sound is coming in at embarrassingly slow, 330 meters per second. However, you've got the neural transmission time and then the transduction, the mechanical versus the chemical, which are compensating to some extent. So if you work it all out, just basically about 12 meters, events about 12 meters away, you should be getting the auditory and the visual simultaneously. But of course, if I walk back and forth like this, I don't get more and more or less. Godzilla badly dubbed movie to you. So your brain is doing a kind of a lot of elaborate compensation, and that's the sort of mechanism that I want to talk about, because it's really that mechanism that's the real story here. That's the real star of the story here. Talking about these kind of temporal integration mechanisms is getting at a sort of the deeper explanation of why this timestamp stuff that Jeremy talks about is right. Of course, there's a connection between the two. I mean, if we have evolved in an environment where the speed of sound and the speed of light were vastly different, then we wouldn't have had the temporal integration mechanisms would be different. But that's the real star of the story, I want to say, and so that's the main thing I want to say. So what I want to say is that what psychologists are now calling simultaneity constancy, which is kind of like, it's not really like it, but they sometimes compare it to perceptual constancy, like size constancy, explains the apparent objectivity of the present. So let me go through some experiments now that suggest this. First, let's take just some simple ones. This one I mentioned in Philippe's talk. There's a well-known one where you put headphones on somebody, stimulate with a tone. If the tone, let the person listen to tones lasting for 1 millisecond. The left and right ears are stimulated simultaneously, then the subject hears not two tones, but one fused tone. But now you can, now you can perturb it so one's coming later, and just keep perturbing it and perturbing it, so it's that's introducing this lag. Eventually, you'll get up to a certain threshold where two tones will still be fused. Up to a certain threshold, two tones will still be fused as one. At a certain point, then your brain, this is where you can see that I'm a philosopher of physics, not trained in the field I'm talking about. This is where the brain just gets fed up, and it says, no, there are two. It can't take it anymore, and then there are two. If I was sophisticated, I would say something more correct. This slide and all experimental slides are shamelessly stolen from various cog scientists, so I have attributions here and there, but I should take no credit for these sorts of things, and probably should go to jail for using these things. Anyway, you have a visual version of this. Watch it. Look on the left-hand side. Simultaneous. Not simultaneous. Not simultaneous. So with less than 20 milliseconds, they seem to be simultaneous. See? If more than 20 seconds, then they seem to be not simultaneous. So for all the different sensory modalities, you've got different resolutions. So these are the fusion thresholds. Interestingly, there's in the vision case, between 20 and 40 milliseconds, you can't tell the order. This slide works very badly, though, so this won't convince you, but it's true. I see the order. That's the problem. obviously, there's an order there. I'd slow that left to right, but anyway, this is neither here nor there for the talk, but it's just kind of cool. Okay, so yeah, we have these sensory simultaneity windows. The interesting thing is the simultaneity windows vary from person to person. So in hearing, for instance, between 2 milliseconds and 5 milliseconds, which is pretty big. It also varies with age, older people fusing more events than younger people. That's why time seems to flow faster when you get older. lots of other factors. And each person, the minimum threshold of simultaneity cannot be shrunk below a certain threshold. Now you can ask, you know, think about the sort of argument against tenses from relativity where you say, well, look, you know, whose inertial frame is the one that's right? Whose inertial frame, whose present is the real one, the privileged one? We could run a kind of psychological version of this. You know, so Hugh and I are fusing together all these different inputs. We're grouping together all these different events differently. Some recent experiments, which are really nice on this by Stone, look at the two points here. The point of subjective simultaneity varied was statistically significant between every single subject. So, you know, now Hugh's grouping together some events as simultaneous. I'm grouping some together as simultaneous. You know, which of us is grabbing the metaphysically distinguished present? But you know, within an individual, the point of subjective simultaneity is remarkably stable. And so you'd sort of expect these things. You know, you'd expect one, I think, on a kind of, you wouldn't be too surprised by one on a kind of mind dependence theory. But then also might expect the second, because, you know, you need to, even if my fusion of events is different than Hugh's, when I'm playing table tennis with Hugh, it better be that my motor control is hooked up to mine and his motor control is hooked up to his, whatever it is. And so it had better be kind of stable if we're going to play table tennis. Okay. Here's the second sort of thing I wanted to talk about. It's the flash lag effect. I don't want that flash lag effect, though. Here it is. Okay, now fixate on the X. Do not follow that circle around. If you do, it won't work. If you fixate on the X, then you should see the yellow lagged behind the direction of motion. Does everyone see that? You've got to fixate on the X. If you follow that thing around, it's not going to happen. Now, if I'm fast with this remote, what I can do is get it on the yellow. I need to stop on the yellow. So this is the first time I've had to play in a video game-like circumstances in the middle of a talk. Okay. You can see it fills the whole circle. Okay. Oh my God. For those of you who missed the beginning of the talk, this is really. Now it was going fast. Oh my God. Oh shoot, I gave away the. No, what is going on? What's that? What do I have to do? Just hit. How do I get just to this page?
Go down to the bottom.
Okay. This? Ah, thanks. Okay. Across the street from me at the Salk Institute, David Eagleman was and Sejanowski was doing a kind of, they were doing a variation of this, which is very interesting, called the, there's a million of them, but they're called the bouncing flash lag effect. This video is not so good, but here the idea is it's going to be the same as before, but at 9 o'clock, the thing's going to bounce off in some direction. And so they have these experiments where the disk bounces off in some random direction. And the interesting thing is, this is very poor animation, but the lag lags in the direction opposite the future direction of the motion, which you think of it as very cool. Now, it's not kind of some spooky backwards causation because it's all happening in the past, but what's happening is your experience of T1 at T3 is hanging on something that happens at T2, if you see what I mean. So here's... You have to fixate on the middle again. That's, again, crucial. Take my word for it. Okay, just an aside. I worry about even mentioning this because this might be the only thing you take away from the talk because it's so shocking. There is Tony, the Italian, in the World Cup just after his goal against France was called offside. There's a long discussion in the journals about whether offside calls are versions of the flash lag effect. Is the motions leading the seeing of the effect, the guy is going offside, then there's the kick of the ball, and the very latest in the Journal of Sports Science says 64 matches, 337 offsides were analyzed. Here's what's really shocking: the error percentage was 26%. It's horrible. As predicted by the flash lag effect, we observed many more flag errors, 86.6%, than non-flag errors.
What is a flag error?
So there are tons of explanations for this, and all these groups and cocci fighting it out. So there's some who say it's motion extrapolation, some who say it's positional averaging, some who say it's latency difference. I have no idea. Interesting thing is that, on any of these theories, there's this sort of integration mechanism is at work, and very clearly at work. You could have used the same sort of thing, the old cutaneous rabbit where you've got the impulses going up the arm, and whether they keep going up, whether you feel at the first few like there's something crawling up, running up you, hangs on whether the later hits happen to you. And so again, you have experience. Your experience of some earlier time T1 hangs on, at T3 hangs on something at T2. In the cocci literature, although philosophers of perception will squirm when they hear the way they talk, but they'll often say time is not its own representation. So there's all this sort of debate about whether brain time or phenomenological time. And so it's sort of like a long debate about like what Philippe would call the temporal matching condition, but with regard to presentness. Okay, now let's get to another one. This one's really pretty good, I think. Now consider again binding between auditory and visual inputs. So this is recalibration between auditory and visual inputs from a common target. We know two features help sound catch up. So sound is coming in miserably slowly, remember, and speed of light is so fast. When the sound gets to you, it's the mechanical transduction in the hairs is much faster than the chemical transduction in your eyes. And then the neural transmission time from the visual cortex to the cerebral cortex is longer than time from the auditory cortex to the cerebral cortex. But as I was saying before, if A and B were the only explanation of why our ability to bind things together as synchronous, we'd only be able to bind together inputs over a restricted range of target distances. So it seems like there's more going on. It was pretty clear, I think, that there's more going on than that. So there's a stolen slide. So there we are. Again, you have the... so this is just what I was saying. You've got it looks like you have some sort of compensation going on, and this is what I'll talk about right now. So there are a bunch of different experiments. One that's very interesting is this one by Cunningham, and others, where it's just a very simple experiment where you just have subjects moving around a mouse, playing some sort of game on a computer. They move the mouse around and moving some image around on the computer screen, introduce a lag. Eventually, your brain gets tired of the lag, and it shortens the lag again and again and again until the subjects claim they experience the movement of the hand with the mouse and the movement of the image on the computer is simultaneous. Interestingly, you could just rapidly turn off the lag, and subjects in that Cunningham group thing reported that the thing went across first and then they moved their mouse. Haggard and others, went about testing this. Oh, I should mention also, we have a grad student at UCSD who has used this kind of erasure of the lag between different inputs, and he's designed this game of rock, paper, scissors, which has a lag. And it's designed so that because of the lag, you always lose, so you cannot win. But subjectively, it feels you can't understand why this is the case. Haggard, went around. Haggard vindicates this experiment because that experiment wasn't like the most rigorous. A nice review article by Eagleman and Alex Holcomb a couple of years ago. Another case of recalibration is that's a lot of work on is what's called temporal ventriloquism. Spatial ventriloquism, right, is when you've got the puppet and the motion, the visual motion of the lips attracts the sound. So the sight attracts the sound. Temporal ventriloquism is the opposite. The sound attracts the sight. And so a temporally proximate audible click captures the flash. So the sound is capturing the flash and changing the point of subjective simultaneity is moving around and affected by the audible click. So Fujisaki says these experiments suggest that the brain attempts to adjust subjective simultaneity across different modalities by detecting and reducing time lags between inputs that likely arise from the same physical events. Okay, so your brain is looking around, trying to coming up with various proxies or rules for when do these inputs likely come from the same target. Okay, Harris, forthcoming, says a reconstructive process involved that is able to resynchronize asynchronous signals by taking into account many factors, both internal and external, which would otherwise distort accurate knowledge of timing. Let's just go quickly to a particularly cool one. This one turned out to be too good to be true, actually. It's true, but it's not as generalizable as I'd hoped. Sugita and Suzuki presented subjects through headphone bursts of white noise, 10 milliseconds duration, to simulate external sound from frontal direction. So imagine them, they're on a football field, and sort of 10 yards, 20 yards, 30 yards, there are all these lighter LEDs. And so they have these bright, brief light flashes, at every 10 yards, 10 meters. And the intensity of the light was altered so as to produce consistent intensity at the eye. Subjects were told to imagine that the LEDs were the source of the light and sound while listening to sound directly from the source. They then estimated the point of subjective simultaneity the way you often do, which came first, light or sound, which came first, light or sound, like this. And the point of subjective simultaneity increased by about 3 milliseconds with each meter increase in distance up to about 40 meters. And now sound travels 1 meter per 3 milliseconds at sea level and room temperature. So they claim that our results show that the brain probably takes sound velocity into account when judging simultaneity. Which, again, if you had that sort of Butterfield-type picture I was sketching, is a kind of, again, a kind of evidence that is more likely given that hypothesis than, or so I would claim. Unfortunately, this result has not been replicated in different. I mean, every time it's been tried to be replicated, they do it differently. I don't think anyone doubts that if you replicate that exact experiment, that exact same thing would happen. And to think that the brain is taking into account sound velocity exactly, that's kind of, if it was really estimating distance of things all the time, I mean, that's really a computationally challenging task, which would take a lot of energy. And so, you know, there's probably all sorts of sort of fixed rules and things, rules of thumb, proxies, where the brain is doing this, and may not be as straightforwardly tuned to the sound like they suggest. Maybe, you know, as Fujisaki et al. Suggest, that the brain tries to reduce lags between inputs that likely arise from the same source. And then a recent experiment that would be the sort of the most natural thing to try if you had that sort of view, does the brain try to reduce the lags between things that are actually in the same spatial location? Then Zambini et al. Just recently showed that that's the case. So subjects are more likely to report stimuli as simultaneous when they originate from the same spatial location than when not. Harris, which is a great review article on this stuff, if you're interested in this stuff, you know, has this sort of three-stage process picture where you first the stimuli are fit into these windows. These are sort of candidates for recalibration, and then unfamiliar stimuli are delayed according to fixed rules, like maybe 40 millisecond delay for sound to be bound with light, plausibly from the same source. And then familiar stimuli. So if you just keep doing it, so this is like the Cunningham lag. So if you just keep repeating something again and again and again, you might get more, sort of fine-grained delays. Now, I'm not an expert on this stuff, and there's lots of open questions about all this stuff. You know, is there one mechanism or more? Harris says more. I tend to think more. Bottom-up or top-down? Fujisaki say top-down. I tend to agree with them. What is the neural basis? So there's all these experiments looking at different areas, like the STS and stuff. But there seems to be one closed question, which is that there's this need for a kind of recalibrating temporal integration mechanism. You know, Stone says it's self-evident. Everyone in the literature thinks it's self-evident. Okay. So we have this sort of temporal integration mechanism. Why do I have a picture of Kant there? Two reasons. One is that there are many historians of philosophy in my department, and I found that if I sprinkle my talks with pictures of Kant, it oils the wheels of the promotion process. The second reason is that in some sense he's right. Now, of course, not really. But in some sense, he's certainly not right about, that the order of the world is mind-dependent. I mean, that is just nuts as far as I can tell to think that, my graduation from college was, that's mind-dependent, that my graduation from college was after my graduation from high school. It just seems crazy to me. But about the present, he's right. That's enough of Kant. Okay. Bearing on the tense debate, okay, we're just going to finish up now. And before I mention this, I should say, in a way, focusing on all this sort of error and variability that I've been doing is a kind of getting things the wrong way around, in a way, from the it's sort of back to front from the way you look at it in the CogSci literature. Because I'm focusing on all the sort of bad where our brains are screwing up this simultaneity constancy mechanism. But really, when you think about all the error, when you think of the different signal speeds coming in, you think about the different neural transmission speeds, you think about the different transduction speeds, how did three wrongs ever make a right? That's really the amazing story here, is how we managed to get pretty accurate judgments about simultaneity, despite all the error, that's really amazing. Nevertheless, I want to focus on the negative. That's my personality. None of these phenomena, of course, prove that our experience of presentness is of a subjective property rather than an objective metaphysical property. Just as from the dualism debate, mind-body dualism debate, just revealing correlations in the mind only goes so far. It doesn't prove that dualism is wrong. But I think it's true that it shows that dualism looks pretty bad. Once you have the detensors have an alternative hypothesis, they can compare this to the alternative tense theory. So the alternative tense theory, again, is that there's some kind of metaphysically distinguished global monadic present. And my theory is that really all this sort of present stuff is a feature of the mind. So the question, so one way to put it is, you know, is our mind grouping together these inputs as present or is the world? And I'm saying it, the evidence is showing that is saying it is the mind. So why? Well, because it bears all the earmarks of something subjective. So this grouping is of inputs into something, binding together something as simultaneous, is highly contingent on environmental variables. What you take yourself to causally affect, what you're attending to, how loud stimuli are, where in the field of vision. I could just list 100 of these things. Varies dramatically from person to person. Varies interpersonally too, depending on your age and stuff. And is dependent on later information. So you can compare it with the dualism debate. So daily discoveries of the dependence of mental phenomena on neural dynamics do not falsify mind-body dualism. You know, you could always think, well, if the physical receiver is broken or at the wrong station, the same tune won't be played. And so you could think of the same kind of thing here. So the advocate of the tense theory could just say, well, I've got this, poor me, I've got this brain that works a certain way, and poor me, the transmission speeds are what they are and whatnot. But it seems like, dualism is still explanatorily inadequate. Why should caffeine and Valium affect my non-material mind's mood differently? Dualist answers are either, stipulative that that's just the way the non-material mind works, or they'll piggyback on the explanation from natural science, but then at the peril of leaving the non-material mind's nothing left to explain. Also, you've got background theories, evolution, biology, and stuff like this that don't seem to require non-physical minds. And so simplicity kicks in, and then dualism looks like a less, not so agreeable. Same exact thing here, I think. We group various experienced inputs together as present. We attempted to think this grouping is done by the world, not us. But we've learned our impression of subjective presentness varies inter-subjectively, and that can be manipulated in a variety of ways. These changes and manipulations are not all what you'd expect if the impression of nowness were the impression of a mind-dependent global monadic present. Tensors must provide stipulative answers to questions such as why age but not weight affects the size of my simultaneity window. Alternatively, they can adopt a detensed answer, but again, only at the risk of leaving tenses with nothing to explain. And the background, tenses aren't needed, it seems. And, if things like the no-go theorem by Putnam are right, then they're not wanted either by the natural sciences. So you don't need them and you don't want them. Simplicity, Occam's razor, then kicks in, and you'd have to say that tense theory is in trouble. And so I think that this is getting closer to my goal of the complete annihilation of the tense theory. So that's it.
Well, since time is not its own representation, and Craig had my watch, I was feeling a bit out of touch with.
Oh, sorry about that.
But actually, I see that was perfectly timed, and we now have half an hour for discussion. So, Dave first, and could the rest of you keep your hands up, please?
Yeah. So, I wasn't completely sure of the form of your reply. Seems to me there were two different forms of. I'm not sure of the argument from experience is meant to be in the first place. Might take two forms. So one is basically you experience, the world, things out there, and you perceptually experience things in the world as being present, objectively present, and that gives us some reason to take there to be objective presentness in the world. That's sort of an argument from perceptual experience. And then the other one's sort of an argument from introspection of all our own experiences. We sort of introspect our own experiences to be objectively present, and that gives us some reason to think that there is such a thing as objective presentness in the world. But the question is whether what you said does anything to undermine either of those arguments. Focus on the perceptual. I mean, it seemed like the central one was the perceptual argument. So perceptually represent the world as being objectively present. I mean, your argument seemed to be basically there are illusions and you can get it wrong and so forth. Therefore, this perceptual evidence doesn't give us much reason to believe it's such a feature of the world. Now, if that's the reply, it looks like same applies to almost any objective, any feature of the world, including manifestly objective features of the world, like shape, right? And you could have gone through your entire talk and given us a whole bunch of examples of how the visual system is constructing shape. that.
No, that's right. But let me distinguish. Yeah.
You could have said the same stuff about succession. So maybe you can clarify.
No, of course. Yeah, of course. Let's just bracket for a second what exactly the tensor's argument from experience is, because I'm not really sure what they're exactly. Well, I mean, I offered the two things you mentioned, and then. But anyway, I mean, to distinguish my argument from the size argument, or you could run the same argument. You know, there are allusions with pigs and stuff like this, and so you know you could get rid of pigs and size and everything else. Indeed, you could do it right in my talk with the evidence I gave on temporal order. I'm not saying the order is mind-dependent, and yet the temporal order could be, you know, screwed around with. So that's absolutely right. But I mean, so what I'm doing though is I'm not just pointing out that there's, you know, we can be wrong, right? So I'm pointing out that there's this alternative hypothesis with this alternative mechanism, which explains why we're wrong, right? So I'm also, there's, I mean, so there's a kind of continuum here where you can look at, suppose I ran that argument with temporal order. Well, then the temporal order argument, I mean, when we compare that now with background theories and stuff like that, I'm not going to have, so the background theories all need the order, right? And the background theories all need pigs and size and stuff like that. So that's playing a role here. So I'm not just pointing out that we could be wrong. I'm pointing out this positive, I'm pointing to this mechanism which predicts that we would be wrong in certain circumstances. And then, of course, the background considerations are playing a role here as well.
And I suspect we're going to say more about the analogy of shapes, but maybe I won't do that as well. But on the introspective argument, if anything, the introspective argument is possibly a little bit more powerful than the perceptual argument. Certainly, the experiences seem to be, have the property of being objectively present, whether or not the world is. Now, the mechanisms here, they all have to do with representation of presentness in the external world, and we can get that wrong, and that's constructive, and that's mind-dependent. But all the evidence you presented, at least, seem to be consistent with the idea that our introspective sense, there's nothing wrong with our, or even particularly mind-dependent about our introspective sense of the presence of certain experiences.
That's a good point. I should think about that. Yeah, I didn't say anything about introspective. I'm trying to think if there's anything. I don't think there's anything done. I don't think there's anything done on that. But
some people say that, you know, the place where we find flow is in consciousness itself. There's two different points. Consciousness represents the world as flowing, and consciousness itself sort of seems to flow from moment to moment. And so if you take that second point, that,
well, I'm not talking about flow, but you
and consciousness has this property of being objectively present.
Well, I'm not talking about flow, but you would mean our introspection binds together various thoughts as the thoughts happening at the same time, or aspects of the thought or something. Yeah.
Finger from Jason.
There's lots about people contradicting themselves when they report their own introspection, whether that's over the time periods that are relevant, whether the details work out to help or not. I'm afraid I don't know, but it's especially over long periods, I think, so I don't know if the results are as neat as the ones you've got for perception.
Yeah, thanks. I need to look at the introspective timing. I don't think, I can tend to doubt that anything's been done, but I don't know.
Jonathan.
This is a very similar question to Dave's, because I too was wondering whether you could make the same sorts of arguments with respect to shape. And in particular, you had, in one of your slides towards the end, you listed four features that the subjective present had, that it was highly dependent on environmental variables, varies dramatically across people, interpersonally across ages, and depends on later information. And your conclusion from citing those four factors was that your view that this was all sort of constructed by the mind dependence view was more highly confirmed given those four factors than some view about mind independence. So I was wondering if you could state. The mind independence hypothesis, something like there's a metaphysical privilege now. So I too was wondering, you know.
Well, like I said to David, I mean, it's not just those four things, right? It's also the background theories, And I mean, so when you make one of these inferences, I mean, of course, if we just focus on that little bit, I mean, everything's like this. But I mean, why do you think some things are mind dependent? Well, because you sometimes have theories of how those things were produced. You don't need, you know, it turns out your background theories don't require those entities in the world. Same sort of thing here. So it's not a kind of automatic. I mean, you're absolutely right that it's, you know, there's never a kind of automatic inference from, you know, variability to. Look, I'm just talking about, you know, IBE, inference to the best explanation. You know, what's the best explanation of all this chair stuff, chairs? And you know, I could be wrong about chairs now and stuff like that, but I don't think that overrides the inference that they're to chairs. On the other hand, you know, when I see pink elephants, you know, now I've got a lot of explaining how they're going to fit those things into, you know, why would evolution produce elephants that could walk through walls and stuff like this. So you're right. I'm not going to go naively just jump from variability to this stuff. But I'm going to. But on the other hand, some things. At some point in the day, so there's a huge continuum when you make a kind of inference between whether something's mind dependent or mind independent. And you know, I don't have I don't think we have any sort of explicit, you know, sort of criterion where we know exactly when to say where one thing is mind independent, one thing is mind dependent. But we look at the usual signs. If the thing varies like this, if we can explain why it does so with some kind of mechanism, and if the background theories don't require it, then I say screw it. It's not in the world.
We've got quite a long queue, so I think there's a finger on this point from David.
Just that physics doesn't have a problem with shape, but it does have a problem with prism. And so that's a big difference between those other things that our mind thinks exist in the real world. But if science agrees, then that's probably correct. But when our mind thinks something exists in the real world that science doesn't find, then that makes this particular perception about it unique. And so therefore subject to the arguments that we're given.
Yeah.
Richard.
One thing that neither you nor Jeremy, according to your presentation of this, you mentioned was intersubjectivity. There's something about communications that makes us think that we're instantaneously in communicative contact with one another. That, of course, depends on all kinds of physical features of the world and of us. And it's interesting, there's some situations in which that breaks down. You know, if you're conducting telephone conversations, going through a satellite, then you don't feel like you're sharing a present moment because there is a time lag.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can sort of get used to it. It's long enough, it's very hard to. That doesn't really. I mean, there's another dimension to look for where the solution comes from, independent of the subjective psychological experiments, or the personal rather than the interpersonal.
Right, I should have mentioned that. I mean, I mentioned in the paper, I mean, yeah, so my brain's like your brain. And so we're. So although it varies, I can figure out. I can see that the point of subjective simultaneity for me and for you, we're going to fuse events differently, but not that differently. To, you know, especially for you know, sort of the events we might talk about. But at a certain point, you know, it is going to be it'll break down like you say in the phone conversation.
Okay, now there's a person whose face I can't see. I think it's Greg. So. Yes.
Yes. Thanks for a great talk. I thought in the discussion that it's just occurred a little while ago, I thought some people were, in a sense, playing Barclay to your lock. I thought that this, I mean, in a way you answered in a way that a lot of people now think the lock did answer, or certainly should have answered, and that's to appeal to inference to the best explanation. So if you have an antecedent, if tensors have a powerful enough antecedent reason to believe in
Can I just answer that right now? Well,
sorry?
Can I answer that right now?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, that's exactly the way I was thinking. Yeah, so, I mean, to Jonathan and David, I mean, if tensors had some other argument for tenses, right, that could easily override the background, the lack of need for it from physics and such. And then, you know, the variability and all the stuff I point to would just, you know, you'd say, well, so what?
So. I was just going to say quickly that I think the another aspect is that the perceptual constancy phenomena, they need to be related to, in a detailed, fairly fine-grained way, to some of these issues about objectivity versus response dependence and so on. And so, for example, you might say that the color constancy, where you see a sheet of paper as the same white paper, whether it's out in sunlight or in this room or whatever, that may be, when looking at it in a fine-grained way, that might be treated a little bit differently from the perceptual constancy of stars at the distance. And you might say that maybe it's an aspect of the way in which colors are response dependent, that we impose a constancy where we might, you know, we might wish to say that it would be cleaner in relation to science to say that there's not a constancy. The last thing I was going to say quickly was that I thought that it also, whilst you're discussing the tense, you know, putting the court as objections to the tensors, the power of the arguments will vary a bit according to which version it is. For example, I found a number of your arguments relatively devastating against the punctate presentism metaphysics, and there'd be all kinds of pragmatic weird effects if somebody tried to answer them. Like, for example, if the constancy mechanism for the simultaneity of the sound and sight seems to be saying, you might say it's fairly, it works in a way to be fairly, to give us a fairly reliable estimate of the simultaneity of a couple of events out there, like your lips and your the sound that's coming. But if it's the other aspects of it, the intra-subjective variability and so forth, and intersubjective, they all seem to mean that it would be really almost impossible to maintain a punctate presentism in the face of all this phenomena. But possibly other versions of a tensor view
Well, there would be tense theories that, you know, don't privilege the present in various ways. So, like, you know, Tim Maudlin has one where you've got little sort of arrows at every point, and no present is picked out, but a kind of directionality is picked out. And so this sort of thing says nothing about that kind of thing. I don't like that kind of thing either, but that's a different day. I think the simultaneity constancy is quite different than perceptual constancy and size constancy when you think about them. So it probably really isn't a great analogy between the two, but apart from the fact that, you know, just as you know, the size of something might stay constant even as you're through all the retinal changes, so the simultaneity of something stays constant despite all the transmission error, the transmission noise. I mean, it's kind of a very, very loose analogy, but and of course there are some things. I mean, I didn't talk about them so much, but there's a lot of experiments on where these mechanisms of simultaneity constancy are engaged and when they're not. So they're not engaged with lots of things, which is interesting. So it's not the same for all the sensory modalities.
Tim.
I want to come back to the first two questions and perhaps push them from a slightly different angle. I took you to be granting that we do have this experience of the present in a metaphysically robust way, and saying we can explain that by reference to these mechanisms of temporal constancy. But you grant, and as David and others brought out again, that there are other mechanisms of perceptual constancy.
not following exactly. I'm granting, for the sake of argument, that there is this kind of phenomenological datum. I'm working, though, in the background where I'm assuming that a tenseless background, and I'm trying to see if I can come up with a tenseless explanation of that.
Of why people have that.
And so then I appeal to these mechanisms that are appearing in the psych literature.
So if those mechanisms were sufficient to explain this intuition or this experience as it applies to the time, why wouldn't parallel mechanisms generate a parallel intuition as it applies to space? But they don't seem to. I mean, no one...
But do we have such parallel mechanisms?
No, they don't. That's the problem for your position, it seems to me.
It seems it's... If we don't have the mechanisms in the spatial case, then it seems like we don't have any datum to, and we don't have any datum to explain. Then that's why I'm confused.
Tim was saying we do have parallel mechanisms, but we don't have parallel intuition.
Oh, okay, okay. So you have parallel mechanisms. So what are the mechanisms? You mean? But I don't think that's a here-ness mechanism.
Well, sure.
Yeah. Okay. I don't want to argue with that. This is pushing on whether really I should even grant. I mean, this is the thing that's always been bothering me about this paper, is trying to identify, what the datum is supposed to be. So I looked at the tensors. I failed utterly, frankly, in finding what it is that they're looking for, and all I can then find. I mean, so then. Now, if I get, I think you're onto something there. If I then grant that there is such a thing, then and explain it, so I'm granting that there's this mysterious thing, and I'm explaining it. Why aren't I then explaining other mysterious things? That's a good point. I need to somehow tinker with that, fix that section two somehow. But I don't know what to say. I mean, everyone says that there's all these tensors say that there's this feature. All I can see is, these mechanisms binding different things together, with these as simultaneous. So any hints as to what I should say, I'd appreciate.
I've got a hint in response to this. I mean, it seems to me that what the data suggests is that in the spatial case, what's being integrated is a kind of map, and now it may be a map centered on us, but it's not a one position map. Whereas in the temporal case, you have something like a one-position map, which is just here. So it seems to me that in the primitive data, there's quite a sharp contrast between the spatial and the temporal cases.
Why do people make the mistake in one case of thinking there's something more than the map in which they're located, and they don't make that parallel mistake in the other case? That's something that needs explaining, surely.
Well, in the spatial case, What they have to do is, I mean, there's some process of integration of the maps at different times, which requires the sort of non-indexable background. Okay, we better go on because we've still got a long queue. So, Philippe, I'm going to ignore your finger.
Okay.
Uriah.
Against the inference, and that actually had the same kind of.
I'm not sure. I'm not so sure I should agree that they're, you know, phenomenologically the same. I mean, that the memory of redness is the same as the sensory impression of redness, or
phenomenologically they're different. Right?
Even. I think the memory is not, well, I don't know, it depends how you think of, I mean, the memory, why is the memory the same?
You have a, this is episodic memory of red. It's like remembering you seeing the red chairs 15 minutes ago. Your eyes closed.
Am I alone in thinking that that's not phenomenal, that that's not the same? Or...
We can imagine that as far as the sensory stuff, it's exactly the same, right? It's a very vivid memory with a very unvivid perception.
Okay. Okay. So, and but yet they're phenomenologically different, you're saying.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. How do you? I mean, well, yeah. How do you know that? It's but. It's I mean that's very helpful because it helps me think of sort of cases of where what they might be thinking when they're thinking that there's a phenomenology of the present. That's a kind of sharp way to put it. Whether I'd want, you know, I don't know, I'm not too comfortable with the swamp man thought experiments to, I don't know, motivate this, but you know.
think of
thanks.
From David.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's right. And that's why they're sort of always in a non-blameworthy sense reading the theory into the data so much, that they're you're reading their beliefs, and that the beliefs can affect the data as well in a way.
Barry. Thank you.
These considerations will affect, you know, some tensors, not other tensors. And even if you have if you're broad and you had a sort of growing block picture, and if you could imagine, you know, broad one, where you think that you've got the growing block picture, and you think that the cusp between being and nothingness also explains presentness phenomenology, then these sorts of things I think would affect broad one. But you might think of broad two, where he just thinks, you know, we've got the growing block, this is going to explain all these sort of asymmetries in our experience, and then that tense theory would not, its goal would not be to explain presentness phenomenology, and then this stuff would be irrelevant to their purposes. No, that's right. This is related to Tim's question. And it's like I said at the beginning, the weak part of the talk, although I say it's not my fault, is because the tensors themselves aren't that clear. One way to put this is I always look at this quote and I always wonder, do I really believe this? So you look at the quote of brain furnishes an integrative mechanism, blah, blah, blah. You know, the now, the subjective present, nothing independently, rather there's an attribute of the content of consciousness. Now, I mean, so is there something there which I'm granting, which is being explained, or is there really just nothing there that I'm explaining? And is that one way to put what you just said? So, I mean, I start off by granting that there is this phenomenological present, and then but because I can't sort of cleanly identify it, I end up, it's kind of... This is what I want. This is the.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, you could say on the basis of that, in agreement with Barry and Philippe, that experience does represent things as present, and this kind of representation as present is not to be understood as reducible to some kind of tenseless representation or presentation. But nonetheless, this does exist in the system of the theory. I mean, just as detenses say, nothing wrong with tense language.
Right.
Further, you have to distinguish the belief that the lecture is happening now from the belief that the lecture is happening at 11 a.m., even if it is now 11 a.m. These are two distinct psychological states someone can be in, but nonetheless, there's no objective present. The theory is true. It's kind of time.
Right.
So you didn't have to sort of... you could go...
represented as present, yeah. Thanks, yeah.
Okay, I think we'll have to make this the last question. Janine.
Recouping the intuition that there's something special about one of these classes is phenomenal.
there's nothing. Yesterday there was. I mean, it's when you had the sun on your neck yesterday, it was bound up with all these other inputs, and that's it. No?
All of that's incorporated into sort of the objective view of the world. Right? I know I'm from T, that the sun on my neck at from T feels a certain way. I have no way of connecting that with experience. Experience doesn't itself come with time.
Right.
I'm not a friend of the tensors.
No, I know, but you're trying to say that there's more to it than what I'm suggesting. But I'm not getting what that more is.
Well, just focus on the idea that look, this, you know, the sun on my neck at time t, the sun on my neck at time t1, the sun on my neck at time t3. None of those tells me anything about what things feel like until I can connect them to now.
Oh, yeah, but I bracketed the sub-knowledge argument, so I bracketed all that, yeah.
None of them feel like anything. I mean, that,
right, yeah, I bracketed all that stuff, because, and I bracketed it because, you know, you can say the same thing in the for the first-person case and the spatial case, and yeah, I don't think that those are good arguments for tensed view, and I don't think you do either. But yeah, we need an explanation of that, but that's not what this is going to... This isn't going to touch that. Yeah. So you can imagine some tensors might say, well, you just haven't... They might say the indexicality aspect is the experiential aspect I'm after. Yeah, and if that's right, then I'm going to point out that the same thing happens with first person, same thing happens in the spatial case, and say your argument doesn't work. So there's a kind of long, you know, divide and conquer, the grand master plan against the tense view. So, yeah, I should have been clear about that. So, yeah, hit him with all that sort of pointing out that the spatial and first person cases with the indexicality stuff doesn't show that there's tenses. If there are any left, then hit him with this stuff. That's the master plan.
Okay, good. Well, unfortunately, although there's still some people on the queue, we've got to stop hitting the tensors for a while so we can have coffee.